Talk given Saturday, 16th of August, 1975. We are all well aware of that piece of advice which is given, namely, there must be right thinking before embarking upon an action. If there is right thinking, it is said, right action will follow. This is the sort of advice given by the worldly person, the one who is regarded wise in the ways of the world. He is supposed to understand human nature. He is supposed to be a practical person. He is supposed to be one who will be able to put you wise also in the same manner in which he is wise. Now let us look at this a little carefully. The worldly minded person is invariably self-oriented. He draws the world unto himself for his own purposes, whether he does it deliberately, willfully, or whether he does it unconsciously, quite naturally, as we would say. What is the sort of thinking that is regarded as right thinking by the world? Is it not thinking which will promote the fulfillment of one's desires, one's ambitions, one's pursuits, which will perhaps alleviate or free one from one's anxieties and fears, all of which belong to the worldly context, meaning thereby the context of constant conflict between self and not self, the context of ambivalence, the love-hate, success-failure, pleasure-pain context, the context of a duality in which one tries to reconcile the opposites, as they are called, but never to transcend them through utter purification and the vision of that which is whole and integrated. So now, all this thinking, which is the silent chatter in the mind, just silent chatter, goes on conditioned by desire, passion, ambition, jealousy, fear, anger, envy, on the one hand, as also by what we call all the finer impulses which characterize the man of the world do. Kindness, generosity, altruism, as it is called, and so forth. Both these sets of qualities, however, remain opposites within the dualistic sphere of thought and of worldly affairs, and are confined within our own psyches in terms of the ambivalence of the psyche. Now, are you and I concerned with this kind of thinking and with the kind of action that follows from this kind of thinking? Another point, are you and I the slaves of ideals, whether they are social ideals, political ideals, whether they are spiritual ideals, and so forth? I put this question particularly with respect to spiritual ideals, which are all too often mistaken for true religiousness, because these ideals are spun out by our minds in the actual condition in which our minds are, which is a condition of confusion, of anxiety, of sorrow, bewilderment, and a constant drawing to oneself that which we think is desirable and pleasurable, and a constant repelling of that which we see as disagreeable, painful. So if our ideals are spun out by this kind of mind, what sort of ideals are they? Then again, consider this fact. The ideal is something which, in actual fact, is ever receding from us. It's like embarking on a journey to the sky. But where the analogy, the simile fails, is here. We know that the sky means that which is unreachable. Therefore, if we attempt to journey towards the sky, we make the attempt with a spirit of fun, knowing that, well, it's a pleasant flight from one unreality to another unreality. But there is a troublesome aspect to this. The ideal tends to be, in practically all cases, with very rare exceptions, a mental fixation. And it is a fixation which prevents the person from seeing the whole truth as it is in the immediate now. And if and when a deeper truth appears before him, which conflicts with the procedure and the processes which he has already embarked upon because of his ideals, then he is stuck. You see, the mind of man is a most extraordinary thing, the way it functions. We have to understand this. Understand it, not merely be possessed of a brilliant analytical, intellectual analysis of it. That is not sufficient. Analysis is taking the thing to pieces. You get a lovely new gold watch presented to you, and if you have the curiosity of the very small child, you'll take a screwdriver and just take all the parts out. Now, what happens? Can you put them together again and make the watch go? You can't. So it's not a brilliant analysis that is required, but understanding, which is an integrative power, a thing of the heart, a thing of mind and emotion in perfect harmony and balance, operating transcendentally and beyond the limitations imposed by the pairs of opposites. This is understanding. Understanding really means the harmony of love and wisdom in their transcendence. Remember that marvelous statement in the Bible, "Give me understanding, O Lord, and I shall keep thy statutes unto the end, yea, unto the very end." It would be better written in the English language, "And I will certainly be able to keep thy statutes unto the end," in complete fulfillment, "if I have understanding. Give me understanding, O Lord." The giver of understanding is the Lord, the transcendent. And this transcendence is within you yourself and within me myself. And it is to that which I pray, not to something outside. Because if I pray to something outside and some sort of brilliant perception emerges in my own mind, I say that the prayer has been answered from outside. Forgetting that whatsoever is given to me from outside can never be more than, that is for me myself, what my own mind can contain. The Lord God himself may come down and tell me the whole truth, but only in so far as I'm already capable of touching that truth, those words will have sense and meaning for me. So the thing to which one prays is the within oneself. Since I've mentioned the Bible, you know how in the early chapters of Genesis, the Lord God constantly makes a new covenant with man, because man breaks the previous covenant. So he makes a new covenant. What sort of a Lord is this? Is it not the lordliness within your own being which makes the new covenant? This urge to transcendence within your own being, which, despite what we call failure, will renew the covenant, the urge, the energy which takes you and forward, as we say, and brings you to your true fruition as a human being. Is it not that? So you see, we can leave out ideals where our thinking is concerned. You will ask, well, what then is right thinking? So far, and with the world all over, it is believed that thinking is the first, the primal stage. It isn't. Where does thinking come from? What is thinking an expression of? Is it not an expression of this mysterious unknown which we name the mind? The ordinary thinking that we know of, and all the clever people, the brilliant people know of, all they are thinking is nothing but a string of words, a silent chatter in their brains. And being a silent chatter consisting of words in the vocabulary, it is a chatter which deals and is concerned with only the known, not the unknown, not the new. At best, it is a procreative process. It is not a truly creative process. And a procreation is true to type, therefore restricted within narrow limits. Human beings procreate only human beings. Donkeys will procreate donkeys, ants, and so forth. Oak trees will give acorns which produce oak trees only. And within their limits, they are confined. But transcendence is something different from that. It's creativeness. Creativeness in the sense of complete newness, of non-repetitiveness. This is the marvel of transcendence. The marvel of, if you like to use the good old word through the ages, of God. The unborn, the unbecome, the unmade. And when out of that one unknown, unknowable, unborn, unbecome, unmade, the entire becoming process starts off, what do we observe? That every element of this becoming process is utterly unique, utterly, it contributes to the infinite variety in terms of multitudinousness of that which is one and only. So now, thinking. Our thinking is confined to the known, to the limited. Who was it who said, thinking never added a cubit to man's stature? Some great mind said that. I forget who at the moment. Now this thinking, which is real thinking, is an expression of the mind which is free, which is unconditioned. Our thinking, this flow of silent chatter, is the expression of the mind which is conditioned, limited, in confusion, in darkness, ignorance, seeking, searching, it knows not what. Now I ask you, how then can there be right thinking for mankind? Unless and until this which we call mind does come to maturity in the living person. We have considered this in other forms at previous meetings. We know that the body comes to fruition, to maturity, because nature does all that. But the maturing of the mind is not nature's business. Nature doesn't do anything that in that direction. It is our business, our individual business. This is where you and I, as individual beings, step on the stage of universal evolution and make our unique and individual contribution to the universal process by bringing the mind to maturity. Just as matter is universal, and out of universal matter, all the innumerable, countless innumerable forms that we see are composed of just that same matter. And they combine and recombine in countless ways and go away. There is only one mind which manifests through all of us, through animals, and in mysterious ways through trees and what we call inanimate phenomena and so forth. There is mind in operation. But in all those cases, the element of mind in them does come to maturity appropriate to the particular kind of manifestation, an animal, a plant, a star, whatever it is. And there is a cosmos. You and I are the only ones who are blots upon the cosmos. Because we... There you are, confirmation. That is why you and I, as human beings, who have the most extraordinary possibility for manifesting divinity itself, are the ones who are constantly making chaos out of cosmos. So our task is to become right-minded. Out of right-mindedness, proceed its two offspring, right thinking and right action. Right thinking implies right speech also, because the thinking, the final conceptualizing process is a verbal process. So it has to include right speech. The meanings of words have to be absolutely clear in our minds. No confusion about them. How is it that we appreciate beautiful literature? Because the word is completely right in its context. Every single word. Isn't that the marvel and the beauty of what man can produce in the realms of art? It's the same with music. You ask your musician who knows, the great composers, every note is the right note in the right place, and so forth. So now, the world as a whole is unhappily ignorant of these fundamental facts. These are not just metaphysical speculations out of an armchair. They are forged in the fires of living experience. That is how you get knowledge which is not a hindrance to wisdom, which means, therefore, not a hindrance to right action, to beautiful action, which means to beautiful living, to healthy, whole living, implying the maturing of the mind in harmony with the maturing of the body. Right-mindedness. Naturally, we question, how can I bring about this desirable state? How wrongly worded is the question? How can I bring about the desirable state? It is precisely I, the egoistic I, separatively self-conscious, imposing himself upon his environment and in conflict with it. And it is precisely my particular desires, because I want them fulfilled, and I do not consider whether they are completely in line with the will of transcendence or not. It is precisely these things which are the fundamental sources of all our misery, difficulty, conflicts from the days of Adam onwards. And I'm using the word Adam to mean the chap who came out of our primordial ancestor, the primate whom we never met. So now, the question is not, how can I bring about this desirable state? But, what is there to be seen, to be understood, by which, because of which, there is no resistance offered by this particular living organism that goes by my own name in the world, to the free functioning of transcendence itself. This is the way to put the question. What is it that I can do then? I, in the sense of the separate individual who is isolatively self-conscious. You know how in the Maitreya and the Skanda Upanishads it is said that the body is the temple. The dweller in the temple is Shiva himself, the third person of the Hindu Trinity. St. Paul also says, "Know ye not, ye are the temple of the Most High." My self-consciousness is the controller of this temple, is the agent appointed with the task of looking after it. What is the task of this agent, which goes by my name? His task is to keep the temple clean. And how does he keep the temple clean? Especially in our early years when we met, I said this times out of number, you can't sprinkle cleanness anywhere. There's no such magic detergent to be obtained. You remove the dirt and the thing is clean. Purity, cleanliness, saucha, is constitutive of our psychophysical being. And this is nature's gift, that actually it does everything possible to start us off with 100% chance of coming to fruition. Perhaps 100% is too much, heredity is not quite so kind. But it's simply extraordinary what life in the living organism does and can do. It's immense power to come through the difficulties and the terrible things we impose upon our own lives. We are self-murderers. Our food, our drink, our mad chase after pleasures, our utter lack of any sort of abstemiousness, self-restraint, and so forth. Our savage self-indulgence in our life. And yet, the lifespan is increasing rather than decreasing. But at what a price? We won't digress into that. It will take too long. So now, nature has started us off like this. And our task is to let the temple be clean. The temple as a building, the physical structure, is more or less a fixed structure. Its functioning we can alter by what we eat, drink, and how we behave, and so forth, by intelligent practice such as games, sport, exercise, yoga, particularly because that brings into play the coordination of the whole musculature with the nervous system. And through the nervous system and the brain, the whole of the psyche comes into play there and in coordination. And of course, the practice of yoga produces tremendous results. That is why we must always approach yoga with an intelligent reverence and seriousness. Thus, the temple is cleansed. And that is the more important aspect, the cleansing, the freeing of the psyche, so that the mind comes to fruition. We have complexes, we have neuroses, we are plagued and cluttered with anxieties and sorrows and fears and problems and so on. Of course we have problems. And man throughout the ages has had and will have problems, because problems are the challenge which life throws to us to bring out more and more divinity from out of us. That is one aspect of it. And also the other aspect, circumstance itself and human beings around us, and even in distant parts of the world nowadays, they present the problems because of their ill thinking and feeling and desiring and their ambitions and their actions. So problems there will always be. Whether you're a saint or a sinner makes no difference. Problems there will always be. But what you and I, through intelligent perception, can really cleanse is just this. We all regard a problem as my problem. If we can be free of the my, then we see the problem in its true light. The moment it is self-oriented, it is ego-oriented, then I, as a separate ego, want to produce a particular desirable result, which need not at all be the true solution of the problem. It will only mean a conflict between my desire and ambition and fear and all the rest of it with that which the problem presents. But if I put myself out of the picture, that is to say, my egoistic drive out of the picture, then I see the problem in its wholeness. It becomes clear. There is no more mist or confusion about it. And so, the resolution of the discord in the psyche into a concord can take place. Again, it's like your skilled musician. He doesn't say, oh, I don't like this discord, out with it. He doesn't put a blue pencil through it. He says, no, it's interesting. The parts of music have arrived at this discord. Now, this is how I'll make them move into a concord. And lo and behold, he makes harmony, beauty, music. Isn't that the case? It's like that with life. Life is a symphony. It's a song. It is not a machine. Even though the machine may be as excellent as a Rolls-Royce engine. So, with this kind of approach, with this kind of understanding, there is a purifying of the psyche which goes on. What practical measure, what practical measures are there in order to bring about such purification? We have considered, as far as I'm able to present them at the moment, the deep principles, the fundamental truths involved in these things. The measure, the instrument of action, where the psyche is concerned, is very simply purity. Purity of thought and feeling, of speech and action. Thought and feeling are mental deeds. Speech is verbal deed. Action is physical deed. They are all deeds. They are all action. Isn't it significant that all the great spiritual teachers laid the supreme emphasis upon simple, pure morality? Morality not in the sense of unintelligent, unquestioned, blind conformity, largely through fear of consequences, with the social, moral code laid down, whether in the name of the state or in the name of religion or God or any authority. Simple purity from within yourself. We are gifted by the grace of whatever this creative energy of the universe is, with the power to see the truth, if we wish to see the truth. That is all. Let the truth become clear and apparent. It is I who put veils between truth and reality and myself. Now, we can appreciate why all the great spiritual teachers laid down as the fundamental basis pure morality. Look what this morality implies. It implies a relinquishment of all unmorality. And what is the fundamental root of unmorality? Selfness. Circumscribing everything around, restricting it in accord, to make it come into accord with what I desire or want. That is the root unmorality. Because it always puts me into conflict with my neighbor and my environment. Because he wants something different. That's all. Simple as that. Several of you are mothers and fathers. Have you seen your little kids quarreling with each other? No, I want this. No, I want this. No, I want it this way. And the other one says, no, I want it that way. There you are. And you and I are no different. We who are adults are really immature adolescents as yet, where the mind and where wisdom and perception and true humanity is concerned. We must see this fact and acknowledge it to ourselves. Not excuse ourselves. Oh yes, of course, the psychologists will analyze and say, oh, well, you see, when you were a little fellow, this thing happened, that thing, that's why you are like this. Yes, all right, this thing happened, that's why I'm like this. Now, I see it so thoroughly, finished. That's the end of it. Don't use it as an excuse for the very next action, for the very next state of mind. This is how purification takes place. So now, with right-mindedness, what happens? The most extraordinary thing is this. I cease to have a mind of my own. You look into that phrase, oh, he has a mind of his own, and with what respect and awe we appreciate the fellow who has a mind of his own. Achieved this, he attained that, he did this mighty thing, he did that mighty thing. In truth, a very successful agent of the devil, he is. If I have a mind of my own, as I call it, it is always in opposition to the mind of the totality, transcendence of God. Always. You must look very deeply into this, having a mind of one's own. But if really right-mindedness has emerged out of this person who bears his own name, then he no longer has a mind of his own. And what happens then? The transcendent mind, the unerring mind, the mind which lies at the root of cosmos, harmony, fruition, perfection, fulfillment, comes into operation in this particular person. Yourself, myself. Now in that situation, what sort of action can follow? But right action, whatever that action may be. You and I can't foresee it. It happens. Can you and I foretell what sort of a sunrise there'll be tomorrow morning? Or a sunset this evening? We can't foretell that, can we? And if we could, visualized it in detail because we have some marvelous clairvoyant ability or some such nonsense. I don't mean that clairvoyance itself is nonsense, but you know what I'm talking about. If we could foretell it, well, when the thing actually happened and we saw it, it would be second hand, wouldn't it? And we'll say, oh yes, there's the sunset. I told you it would be like that. And the zest of life, the real happiness of life, which means the creative moment here now, the unknown, the unknowable, the immeasurable bliss of true creation, where I have not interfered, so now, apply this in everyday life, in every single situation. Watch very carefully and see how selfness, self-orientedness, self-interest, and all the littleness and imprisonment born of selfness cribs, cabins and confines us. Be quite open to the transcendent reality, uninterested in worldly values. We deal in the world, of course. We deal with the world. We have to deal with all that arises in the world, here and now, in and around us. True. But deal with it as gods, not as subhumans. This is a matter of vision, of right-mindedness, out of which comes the right thinking and the right action. Don't misinterpret this and say, ah, all pain and tears will be over. Not a bit of it. If the atmosphere around this earth did not shed constant tears, we'd be parched and die. Rain must fall. If the right rain falls, there are tears of joy. Haven't you known tears of joy? Haven't you known those marvelous, magical moments, like lightning flashes of the transcendent, when suddenly the whole of reality was revealed unto you and you were just one with it for an instant? And what happens to the body itself? There is a startle of tears. in which there is no fear, no hate, no possessiveness. And that is a state of fruition and fulfillment, of right-mindedness, right thinking, and right action.